I don't know why my Republican colleagues can't take yes for an answer. We are opening up over 305 million acres.
Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. House play role reversal on an energy bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 17th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, along with the rest of Wall Street, the Permanent Fund suffers losses.
About $837 million. Very large amount of money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
The U.S. House passed an energy bill last night that would allow offshore oil drilling in the Atlantic and Pacific, but it has to be at least 50 miles out at sea. In a twist that would have seemed unlikely a year ago, Democrats mostly supported the bill, and Republicans were against it in a 236 to 189 vote. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
House Republicans have been pushing for offshore drilling. Some even staged a protest last month in Washington, proclaiming they would not go home for the August recess until Congress voted to drill in the Outer Continental Shelf. But most Republicans say the Democratic-sponsored energy bill does not go far enough.
You can get more energy out of this bill, ladies and gentlemen, if you take all the copies of the bill and put it in a bonfire.
Alaska Congressman Don Young railed against the plan. He wanted a Republican bill considered, which would allow drilling 3 miles from the coast in any federal waters and in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
It does leave out ANWR. I wasn't going to bring that up, but the closest, quickest way to produce 1 million barrels a day to the United States was the open ANWR.
Young says under the Democratic bill, there's no incentive for states to allow drilling off their shores because it does not include revenue sharing. In the Republican plan, coastal states like Alaska would get billions of dollars in royalty and leasing money, eventually taking 37% of federal revenue from drilling offshore. Democrats have long fought offshore oil drilling, but made concessions in recent weeks, saying it was necessary in order to get other parts of an energy bill passed. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the loosening of her party's position is not necessarily a switch.
Well, it's not a question of more drilling. It's a question of I was opposed to the idea that the House would vote in isolation on a drill bill predicated on the idea that if we could only drill in the Outer Continental Shelf, we would bring down the price at the pump immediately. It was a hoax on the American people.
Pelosi angered Republicans by not allowing any amendments, but Democrats call the bill a compromise. It will likely help Democrats from oil patch states on the campaign trail this fall, like Gene Green, who represents Houston, Texas.
I don't know why my Republican colleagues can't take yes for an answer. We are opening up over 305 million acres. Now, granted, it's a compromise, but when you're in charge, we opened up 8 million acres in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. I'd like to open up more. But again, like you had to make compromises, we have. But for the first time, we're going to open up more Outer Continental Shelf opportunity than in history, even under years of Republican House control, Senate control, and the president.
Other Democrats pointed to the tougher stance the bill has on the oil industry. It rolls back tax breaks for the 5 largest companies. It would also release 70 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to lower gas prices, and it contains green goals. Utilities would have to generate 15% of electricity from renewable sources, and it would give tax breaks for conservation and energy efficiency. President Bush has threatened to veto the bill if it passes the Senate. As the days tick away before the election, prospects for drilling in the Arctic Refuge are very dim in the Democrat-controlled House and Senate. And ANWR exploration can be a touchy subject for some Republicans, since their party's candidate, John McCain, is against it. However, on the House floor Tuesday, Congressman Young said he has hope. He sees an advantage to having Alaska's Governor Sarah Palin in ANWR Anwar drilling advocate on the McCain ticket.
I convinced with her great personality and her knowledge, she'll be able to convince in the right way more than we can do Mr. Obama.
The comment was surprising, coming from Young, who has criticized the Palin administration in the past. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
An inflated Alaska energy output figure touted by Governor Palin on national TV last week and since repeated by John McCain is being widely discredited. Palin told ABC News in her first media interview since being named McCain's running mate that Alaska produces nearly 20% of the U.S. domestic supply of energy. Palin has since modified the claim to 20% of domestic oil and gas. But Alaska oil industry analyst Richard Feinberg says the figure is wrong no matter how you look at it.
At roughly 720,000 barrels per day, we are producing roughly 1.5% of the nation's total energy supply. If you go to oil, 720,000 barrels is about 9% of domestic production.
Feinberg, who was a member of the Palin team that overhauled Alaska's oil production tax last year, says the governor's estimate undermines McCain's description of her as an energy expert. Democratic candidate Barack Obama's campaign also noted the erroneous figure, as did factcheck.org and the Associated Press. Resource Council of Alaska Deputy Director Carl Portman told the AP that Alaska did produce an average of about 20% of the nation's oil and gas production during a period stretching from the 1980s into the 1990s. The stock market plunge on Monday, followed by another 450-point drop today, has Wall Street investors nervous about the possibility of other financial giants toppling. Many Americans feel disconnected from the roller coaster investment ride because they don't own stocks. But all Alaskans are stockholders through the Permanent Fund. Fund CEO Michael Burns says Monday was probably the fund's largest one-day dollar loss. He says fluctuations both in the market and the federal government's approach to it have varied greatly.
I think the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are making some very difficult decisions and trying to thread the needle. And I think it appears they're doing a good job, but it's a very delicate task.
What did we lose on that day on Monday?
About $837 million. Very large amount of money.
And so are we seeing a lot of wild fluctuation like that in the amount? $837 million is a tremendous amount of money. What is there anything that's come close to that in this past year?
Actually, if you go back to the few days around the collapse of Bear Stearns, I think it was the day before, I think the markets caused us a loss of, I think, $630 million. And the day after the Bear Stearns situation was resolved, the portfolio was up $675 million. So, you know, there's been a lot of volatility all year.
How nervous does that make you as someone who probably would like more stability in these things?
I don't know if nervous, but certainly incredibly attentive. I mean, I think all of us here and the managers that we use all over the world, but especially the people here, the staff here, I think understand completely how important the Permanent Fund is to the economic and financial future of the state of Alaska. So people take this very seriously, and when the markets are stressed like this, it adds to the stress level.
Well, in view of these major developments in the financial services industry, will you be recommending adjustments in the fund's investment mix?
The diversification of the whole fund is the most important job that we do, and is the strength of a fund like ours or any institutional fund, whether it's a pension fund or an endowment or whatever. It's that broad diversification. So generally, a weakness in one area will provide strength to the other, and I think over time that is truly the case.
There's been speculation, a lot of talk from some analysts in the last several days that ranging from we could be on the brink of a second Great Depression to it's going to be somewhat rough for a while, yet we'll be okay. So how about your crystal ball, Mr. Burns? What do you think the realistic outlook is, or is it still very much unknown at this point?
I think it's very much unknown, but I don't know that I put the option, the first one that you put forth, an ultimate collapse. I don't see that at all. I mean, I think the government probably, if there's a criticism right now, maybe it's been overly active, maybe has been too proactive in trying to avoid some of these things. I think they've done a good job. There are some people very critical that think that we should have let more of these institutions go. So, I mean, that was the attitude, as you said, as you noted, back in the Great Depression. Just let them go. I don't think we're in any kind of position at all to have that kind of thought process.
Michael Burns is the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a successful trip through the Northwest Passage.
When you see an expanse of ice and you've got to work your way through it, there's a great sense of accomplishment after coming through it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage. And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
U.S. Senate candidate Mark Begich today said government assistance for rural Alaska must be based on ideas and priorities that begin in rural communities. He told a group at the Native Health Center in Anchorage that he has always tried to listen to people and the issues they bring up, and he says he has learned that urban and rural Alaska need each other. They are interconnected. He described the state's energy problems as critical.
The energy crisis we face today is something that occurred really over the last 30, 40 years of inaction. People were not focused on the long-term energy crisis that was coming around the horizon. Now we're facing it. It doesn't matter where you travel within rural Alaska, the energy crisis is there.
Begich has a plan that he says reduces energy costs in rural communities. He calls for more development of non-renewable resources, such as wind, solar, geothermal, and hydro projects. He said the projects must also include jobs and training from local communities. Begich has other priorities and proposals for rural Alaska, from healthcare to education. Incumbent Senator Ted Stevens' staff did not return calls today to comment on Begich's proposals. In the mid-90s, human remains more than 10,000 years old were found on Prince of Wales Island. The discovery fueled scientific research about early human migration and the climate of Alaska. Now, as KRBD's Jay Marble reports, the need to keep those human remains has ended, and they're being returned to the Earth.
In the driest terms, the remains found on Prince of Wales Island have been studied to exhaustion. Current scientific methods cannot get any more information out of them. The remains have been determined to be indigenous or from here, and they were found on the ancestral land of the Tlingit. A request for transfer of custody by the tribal governments in Craig and Kluwak was determined to meet the requirements of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, so the remains will be handed over. But at 10,300 years old, these are by far the oldest remains ever transferred under NAGPRA. Dennis Nickerson is with the Kluwak Cooperative Association, and he's been coordinating the meetings for the activities surrounding the return. He says he's aware of discussions about exactly whose relative this person is.
It's we've came across that, you know, should we call him a Tlingit, should we call him a Haida, you know, and whatnot. But, you know, whether or not he is or isn't, you know, we're welcoming him with open arms and on our land. You know, and we've always been like that. You know, we've never disrespected visitors before. You know, whether or not his blood lineage shows he's Tlingit, Haida, Native American, you know, he's a visitor, and that's what we're welcoming him as, you know, with the highest respect.
Nickerson says when he thinks about this man, he remembers that he was between 20 and 30 years old and was found in a cave with the remains of animals. Maybe there was a struggle. It's hard not to let your imagination wander when contemplating what this man was doing so long ago. Imagination is also required when figuring out how to return these remains to where they were discovered. Nickerson says on the 26th and 27th of September, there will be ceremonies in Kluwak. These will be the most public of events, with scientists, tribal groups, the Forest Service, and government types, including the Secretary of Agriculture, presenting and observing.
It's an open house invitation for residents, people that are interested and whatnot. There's going to be some presentations from the scientists. Friday and Saturday evening, we have a potluck, some traditional dancing that's going to be happening. And we have some stuff that's going to be happening, you know, during and around that time when our ancestors are going to be put back to rest.
When it comes time to actually place the remains back into the ground, Nickerson says it will be a much more private affair by invitation only. He says among the items going into the ground is a bent wood box.
The bent wood box has the design made from our master carver, John Rowan, and it has a cedar mat that's being made by another weaver that's going to wrap around the box, and all of that is going to be covered by a mat. And we also have a stone that was taken from Prince of Wales Island that is going to be blasted down here at Stone Arts of Alaska and whatnot, and it's going to be a monument stone for Shukaka.
That's the name that will go on the monument stone. Nickerson says it means man ahead of us. One person who studied Shukaka before he was given that name is Terry Fifield, the Forest Service archaeologist on Prince of Wales Island. He says the presence of the human and animal remains in the cave tell us a lot about what this place was like thousands of years ago. Analyzing the remains has revealed that this person ate sea mammals rather than land animals. His diet and his location add weight to ideas about how humans came to the Americas.
The archaeologists and other scientists that study the ideas of peopling of the Americas have looked at a bunch of different explanations of how people could have gotten to the Americas. Trans-Pacific crossings, coastal migration, the ice-free corridor, the mastodon hunters that came across the plains of Beringia during the last ice age. What this tells us is that people very early on, 10,300 years ago, were on the coast, and that the coastal habitat was there that would have supported human occupation several thousand years before that. So it gives us reasons to look harder at that coastal migration theory for peopling of the Americas.
Fifield and others looking for remains of humans older than Shukaka have some big challenges. Sea levels were much lower back in those days, and if the people were coastal dwellers, the land they most likely frequented is now underwater. I'm Jay Marble.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Alaska's Marine Transportation Advisory Board is coming back to life. Governor Sarah Palin has appointed 11 people to the panel, which has been in limbo for several months. It had been dependent on executive orders from the governor. The board, which works with ferry system managers, is now written into law. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld caught up with several MTAB members on board the ferry Taku and has this report.
The new Marine Transportation Advisory Board was created under terms of legislation passed earlier this year. The bill was signed into law several months ago, but it took until this month to name all 11 of its members. The names are largely familiar. 8 of the appointees served previously on the board, created during the Murkowski administration and reconfigured under Palin. One returning member is Robert Venables, former Haynesboro manager, now energy coordinator for the Southeast Conference. He expects the panel to continue its focus on schedules, vessels, and spending.
We're kind of, you know, really just getting started with this new group that was appointed at the beginning of Governor Palin's administration. And so, you know, I think we've got some good chemistry and good perspectives that each one has brought. And to see that continue, I think it's just kind of a vote of confidence in the work that's been done to date.
Other returning members are Angoon's Maxine Thompson, Ketchikan's J.C. Conley and William Hopkins, Skagway's Mike Korsmo, Juneau's Kathy Romick, Cordova's Clay Coplin, and Unalaska's Shirley Markart. New members are Sitka's Jerry Hope and Anchorage's William Beck and Mark Eliason. Legislation required representation from a community not directly served by state ferries. Venables hopes South Central members help continue a statewide trend toward support for the Marine Highway, which carries tourists and members of the military to the rail belt.
I think there's been a growing awareness from the legislators in the other parts of the state that the Marine Highway system really does benefit more than just the coastal communities that it actually docks the vessel in. And so we've seen, I've seen more support this past year for the Marine Highway system than I've seen in many years, and I've been very grateful to see legislators across the state supporting the needs of the system.
The Marine Highway system has seen a recent growth in ridership after years of declines. Managers credit schedule changes and discount promotions, but the ferries have also had to deal with major cost increases. Thompson, former Rangoon mayor, says the budget is one of two major advisory board priorities.
Right now, the priority is if we focus on our fuel consumption that our vessels are facing right now and how to creatively address that so that all of us understand, so that we know that when they come to us with a budget that is a realistic budget as much as they can address. And the other one is vessel replacement.
A number of ferries are decades old and will need major repairs or a replacement in the near future. The Marine Transportation Advisory Board is only what its title says, a body that gives advice and hasn't always been heard. Enabling legislation, authored by Wrangell Representative Peggy Wilson, originally gave the panel more power, including a voice in hiring the ferry's top manager. But compromises needed to get it through the legislature brought it back to an advisory role. Still, observers are optimistic. Southeast Conference Board President John Bowling of Craig says the appointees he knows can do what needs to be done. He sees the board's biggest job is working with ferry system staff to create the schedule.
They can provide some support to the governor in convincing the legislature to fund Marine Highway and help meet its expenses. But I think primarily MTAB is going to be focused on providing input on the scheduling of the Marine Highway system. And while the cost of operating the system will certainly play into that, I think it'll be secondary to maintaining the schedule that the communities like.
The board will hold its first face-to-face meeting later this month in Juneau. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from onboard the ferry Taku, sailing from Ketchikan to Prince Rupert, British Columbia.
The past two summers have seen record low sea ice levels in the Arctic. Scientists with NASA and the National Snow and Ice Data Center say that as of last Friday, sea ice covered 1.74 million square miles of the Arctic, the second lowest level on record. The melt-off means increased shipping traffic through the Northwest Passage, a route that goes over the top of the world and has long been talked about as an alternative to the Panama Canal. But it also means an increase in the number of cruise ships and recreational boaters in the region. One such boat stopped in Kodiak this week. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Walt Jones is the owner and captain of the Geraldine, a 46-foot former Maine lobster boat that he converted into a yacht over the past 2 years.
So people ask, is it the boat that caused you to do the Northwest Passage, or did the Northwest Passage attraction cause you to get the boat? And the answer is kind of yes, in both directions.
Jones is a tall man, maybe 6'3 or 6'4, not exactly the type of guy you'd expect to be comfortable in the cramped 400 square feet of living space aboard the Geraldine. But have him give you a tour, and clearly he is. Just listen to him describe the pilot house slash salon.
What we say about this is that this is our living room, dining room, family room, den, you know, general purpose room. The whole thing is everything happens right here.
Below deck, there's a small galley, a pair of staterooms, and two tiny bathrooms. It's in this space that Jones and a revolving door crew, including his wife Kip, his boss, and his boss's son, have spent 2.5 months journeying across the top of the world. They started in Southwest Harbor, Maine in late June and arrived in Kodiak Sunday night. Their final destination is Sitka, which they hope to reach in a couple of weeks, and where the Geraldine will stay permanently. When asked what in the world possessed him to try such a trip, Jones says because it's there.
You know, it's an opportunity to do something that most people wouldn't normally do. And so there was a challenge of it. We have loved Southeast Alaska for some time, and we wanted a boat to be up here. And so we looked for a suitable vessel, and we thought when we found one in Maine, we thought, why not do this trip? So we did an extensive refurbishment on the boat with the intention then of doing the Northwest Passage.
Kip Jones was aboard for the whole trip up until Nome, when she flew back to the family's home in the San Francisco Bay Area for a little break and to take care of some personal business. She rejoined in Kodiak and says despite the close quarters, there's been little, if any, tension, something she attributes to the home-cooked meals she prepared every day.
I think if everybody smells something good cooking and knows that they're going to get something wonderful to eat for lunch or breakfast or dinner, and then to sit down together, it just sort of soothes that away. I think it happens in a home, but I think on the boat it was particularly important.
Besides the Joneses, the trip has also included Walt's boss, Pat Robertson, not the televangelist, and his son Shane, who joined up in Newfoundland. Walt, who worked high-tech jobs in Silicon Valley before becoming the major fundraiser for the nonprofit and non-denominational City Team Ministries, says it's easy to take a leave of absence from your job when you invite your boss along for the ride.
And the other little interesting tidbit is that he's my boss at City Team, but I was his boss on Geraldine.
Pat Robertson departed in Unalaska. Shane Robertson will leave once they reach Seward. Throughout the trip, Shane has served as the unofficial mechanic, fixing the Geraldine's engine anytime she broke down. He says there's a huge sense of pride having gone through the Northwest Passage, which is still mostly ice, with only the tiniest slivers of open water to navigate through.
When you see an expanse of ice and you've got to work your way through it, there's a great sense of accomplishment after coming through it. Even after with all of the failures, when you get to the end of it and you kind of look back and you say, we've made it through all of this, that is a huge highlight.
However, Walt Jones says the most difficult part of the trip wasn't going through the ice, which actually calms the ocean. The toughest part, he says, was the Bering Sea.
The Bering Sea is very unforgiving. And there's no place to go, and so you just have to tough it out, and it was pretty rough.
Conditions for the trip turned out to be a little less ideal this summer than they were last year, but Jones says there were still three other boats under 60 feet that made the trip. He says as far as anyone knows, there have only been 34 boats in history that have done it, but he expects that it will become more common in the future.
I think so. The first American boat went through under 60 feet last year, and that was a boat called Cloud Nine. It was a Bowman 57-foot sailboat, and they basically were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal saying that they actually had no issues with ice whatsoever. They sailed right through, and so I thought many more people would attempt it this year, and I was quite surprised that they didn't. And I think we'll see more development. You know, Nome is putting extensive infrastructure in, getting ready for traffic.
The Geraldine left Kodiak Tuesday, heading to Seward. From Seward, they were planning to cruise past Columbia Glacier and make a few stops in Prince William Sound, then continue on to their final destination of Sitka. I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Marble and Craig, Ed Schoenfeld on the Ferry Taku, and Casey Kelly in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.